This is Hazel Khan, and you're tuned to North Fork Works, where every month I introduce you, my listeners, to one of my neighbors, most of whom I haven't met before either. I think of my program as a place where connections are made and where people discover who else lives and works in our North Fork community. My guest today is Dave Dominey, who lives in Cutchogue and who does several things I want to find out more about. First of all, welcome to North Fork Works, Dave.
Thank you for having me.
You're a carpenter, you're a hunter, and you're active in Southold Town's Deer Management Program. Is that right?
Yes, I am.
Okay. But before we come to the present, let's rewind a bit and go back to actually what brought you to the North Fork, because I don't think you were born here.
I was not. I grew up the son of a military father. He was a career military man, served in the United States Army for 34 years. So I moved all over. And so home was a new place every 2 or 3 years. We've lived pretty much all up and down the Eastern Seaboard, Savannah, Georgia, Washington, D.C. area. Spent time in Heidelberg, Germany. Lived in Omaha, Nebraska. So I think by the time I graduated high school, we had had 9 moves with the family. So,
do you like moving?
You know, I don't know that I know anything different. It was what I did. It's how I grew up. So home was always just family for me. Wherever we were was always someplace new, but together as a family, it always felt like home. The North Fork, my ex-wife at the time, I met in college, was from New Suffolk. Oh. So after many visits through college coming up here, certainly loved the area and thought it would be a wonderful place to raise a family. At that time, I had 2 children and decided that they were getting to age, they were going to start school, and we made the move and moved up to Long Island and have been out here since 2005, 10 years in October, actually. I love it. I love the small community. I love the fact that, you know, when I looked at the school system here, I was able to send my children to public schools. They had fantastic student-to-teacher ratios. It's very easy to get involved in the community. There's so many options. To be honest with you, I just don't enjoy traffic. So I went to the University of Georgia, and there I studied agricultural economics and didn't really know what I wanted to do with that.
Yeah, I don't know what you did do with that.
I didn't do anything with it, Hazel, at all. So ultimately, I sold insurance for a couple years and did not like that. And that's when I first got interested in the building business and never have left since then. So I started on the commercial side, worked for a large commercial builder, and then have sort of downsized over the years. And now I'm more of a boutique builder. I do small additions, renovations, and that's really what I enjoy because I get to have a relationship with my customers and really have personal touch and be more involved on the actual carpentry side.
So you think you'll continue this work, or do you have something else that you see you might get into?
This is the field for me. On my mother's side, my grandfather was a builder, and on my father's side, generations ago, the Domineys that came to East Hampton were builders and furniture makers. So I think it's something that's in my blood, and it's something that's going to continue to stay in my blood, and I'll never leave it.
Did you inherit any of your father's tools?
I did not. My father was not necessarily a builder. My grandfather on my mother's side, I did not inherit a whole lot of his tools just because he was building in the late 20s, early 30s and 40s. And we've come a long way with technology and tools.
So. Yeah, but still there might be some old-fashioned things that are really working, you know, that I thought, but maybe not.
No, not even a hammer, actually.
Your name, Dominey, I think you told me once.
The Dominey family, I believe when they came over, and I'm not exactly sure of the year, but I know they settled in East Hampton. And Nathaniel Dominey, who is, I believe, a 7th great-grandfather on my side of the family, they settled East Hampton, were responsible with building the Hook Mill in East Hampton from lumber from Gardner's Bay. So they've been entrenched on both forks, actually, for many a generation.
But you came here because you met your future wife.
Yes, but it was an easy trip to come home, to be close to roots.
Because you'd already been here as a child and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
I see. Oh, but basically you've answered my question, because one of them was, how did you learn your trade?
A lot of what I've learned in the trade has been self-taught. I guess I learned my work ethic from my father, but actually learning the trade I learned because I had a passion for it and studied it hard and practiced it. I worked for a lot of builders, as everybody does in this business. And then eventually you just have to kind of take that leap and decide you can do it and figure it out. And hopefully what you build makes people happy.
You know, what I really wanted to talk mostly about is about hunting. But first of all, I'd like to know how you came to hunting. Was it something you just picked up here 10 years ago?
Or? No, my father was an avid outdoorsman and was exposed to hunting and fishing and the outdoors from the time I was a child. One of the benefits to moving every 2 or 3 years was being in a different part of the country. We lived in Savannah, Georgia, so there was kind of maybe where I got the first taste of saltwater in my blood and being around shellfish. And then we lived in Nebraska. And first thing I was introduced to was small game hunting, pheasant, quail. I think part of it was just to be able to get outside and actually learn to appreciate nature and appreciate what it can provide, the beauty of it. And then also being able to provide for your family.
Food.
So from that point, I really got interested into sort of the bigger game hunting side of it in high school. We were living in the Washington, D.C. area, in Virginia, primarily. I started hunting whitetail deer, wild turkey, and I will tell you, this was in the late 80s, and I can remember it was a big deal if you saw a deer when you would go sit. It was a great day if you saw something, even if it was the flash of a whitetail, and that was exciting. And now you're disappointed if you don't see a deer in 5 minutes when you're sitting down somewhere.
So to hunt,
yeah.
So what is it? Do you call them weapons or implements or?
I guess it's a weapon you're using when you're hunting. And I've hunted with all forms of them. I've hunted with shotgun. I've hunted with rifles. Primarily the last 15 years, I've hunted with archery equipment, bow and arrow.
Does that include crossbow?
They have not hunted with a crossbow. It is a different form of weapon that is gone back and forth with debate, and some states will allow that to be used as archery. Some states treat it more as a weapon and it falls under the firearm status. But I've always enjoyed the bow and arrow aspect of it and archery, and it sort of put me at a closer playing field with the game that I saw, and everything moved in. Instead of seeing things 200 yards away, you're forced to start seeing things at 15 and 20 yards away. So I learned more about the game that I was pursuing and really just enjoyed that challenge of it.
How many bows and arrows do you have?
I just have one bow and arrow now. It's probably the fifth bow and arrow that I've had over time.
But one is enough.
What
kind of money do they such things cost?
They're not cheap. I would say to outfit yourself properly, you're in the, say, $650 to as much as $2,000, depending on where you go with it.
And they're made in the U.S.?
I'm sure they're made all over, but yes, primarily. There's as many brands of bow and arrows as there are shoes.
Well, so I've never gone shopping for them, so now I'll know. I want to talk objectively about the deer problem in Southold. I'd like you to describe it, what the problem is. Most people living in our communities will agree that we have a deer problem. And that is brought about by serious overpopulation, simply too many deer. And then with them come the ticks and the tick-borne diseases that they bring. Mm-hmm. So one obvious method for managing this is to cull the deer. And one obvious way of culling the deer by killing them is hunting. What are the main dimensions, the metrics, the numbers associated with deer and hunting on the North Fork? I mean, how many deer do we think there are?
Well, that is the million-dollar question. I guess the easiest way to answer this is when you look at a healthy deer herd, certain metrics that people use is how many deer per square mile do we have? And to have a healthy, sustainable herd, you want about 16 to 18 deer per square mile, and in some cases less. There are numbers that have been thrown around in the North Fork, the Southold Township area, that we could have as many as 50 to 75 deer per square mile. When you reach those numbers, it's almost impossible to even just maintain. You start to see the overpopulation, and that's where forests, undergrowth, and just the browse in general that deer can do, you start to really see that damage.
Browsing the forest.
The bushes, anything. They are constant foragers, and you will see that, and it is devastating. Not just to farmers, but to homeowners and to just the health of a forest in general.
I know there's the browse line, right?
Which yes. Is...
Below that, nothing seems to grow because they've eaten it all.
Right. Most people would say 6 to 7 feet.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's the easiest thing to look at. If you're driving down the road and you look at somebody's bushes in their front yard, their privet hedges, it'll appear that somebody trimmed the bushes to make that browse line at 7 feet. And that wasn't the landscaper. It's usually the white-tailed deer that did that.
That's obviously one of the problems. And then we could get into the other problems, but much has been written about it, and we've talked about it on my program and in other places. So we know about traffic accidents and the ticks, the diseases.
Yes.
And water contamination, things like this. So let's not talk about that, but let's talk about how you see hunting as a solution.
As you mentioned, Hazel, there are so many different angles to approach an overpopulation. One of the most affordable and I find effective methods to do that is to hunt. And the state has allowed hunters to basically harvest as many deer, antlerless deer especially, which are does, female deer, as you can.
Why is the emphasis on the does?
Well, the does, they're the ones that carry fawns. Oh. And so when you reduce that amount, you will reduce your herd size, in theory. Hunting is by far the most affordable method to try to maintain a population or reduce a population. And to me, you know, I enjoy the outdoors. I love to hunt. You have to really make an effort to do your part as a hunter if we are going to reduce herd sizes and get them back to a manageable.
What does that mean to your part?
Number one, it's time consuming. It's not that you just go out and harvest a deer on any given night. I mean, there are so many factors that have to go in to even having the opportunity to ethically harvest a deer and not just go out there like it's the Wild West. There has been a setback change which opens up more property and access for hunters. In the past, you had to be at least 500 feet away from a dwelling to safely hunt with archery. And Suffolk County is primarily all archery season, except for a time in January where you can hunt with a shotgun. That's what the state law is on that during the hunting season. So now that setback is 150 feet. It has helped. Number one, it opened up more areas to allow hunters to be in there. There are sections of neighborhoods that are preserved lands that now hunters are able to hunt within communities.
Okay, and the nuisance permit, how does that work?
The nuisance permit is separate from any hunting regulation. Usually most people that have a nuisance permit own a farm, a vineyard, a nursery. So the state will come down, evaluate what methods they will allow you to nuisance hunt the deer with, whether it's shotgun, bow and arrow, crossbow. And they will allot you a certain number of tags, antlerless tags, to harvest as many deer as they give you tags for. When you harvest the animal, you have a number, you place the tag on the game to show that it was reported, and then that is in turn reported back to the state. So they're able to at least keep some track of it.
I mean, one of the things that I've learned being involved with deer is that hunting divides people. It's divided this town. I'll tell you the truth. When I first was in the proximity of hunters, I thought, these are really bad guys. I don't even want to sit next to them. You know, these are people who kill deer. They are animals. They're merciless. They just do it for the hell of it and all that stuff. I've very much changed my mind. But how do you see it?
I take a lot of pride in being an ethical hunter. Most hunters you will meet are of the same mind.
What is an ethical hunter?
An ethical hunter is somebody that, number one, abides by state laws, also understands, you know, you are taking the life of an animal. If you understand that, you want it to be as humane and as quick as possible. Somebody that sees the need and the use of that animal and takes pride in being able to provide for their family, or maybe they donate it and it's used for homeless shelters. The venison side of it. So with that being said, the division you asked me about, I don't see a huge division, especially with the problem we have now. I was pleasantly surprised to see people be very open-minded. Whether they completely love the concept of hunting, I think they understand the need. And it is a resource that should be tapped into to help with this overpopulation of deer.
Dave Dominey is talking about his life and work on the North Fork, where he is a carpenter, a recreational hunter, and serves on the South Old Town Deer Management Task Force. This is Hazel Kahn and North Fork Works on WPKN Radio.
After this winter, which obviously was a tough winter, There is nothing worse than seeing an animal that is starved. Mm. When you watch and you see it or you find it, it is, there's nothing worse than that. And so I totally agree with letting nature take its course. But you know, we've also manipulated a little bit of nature ourselves. And so we haven't given them the best opportunity to let nature take its course all the time. So I love to look at deer as well. My brain is not just dialed in to go hunt and to watch the death of an animal. That's not what a hunter really is. I think you'll find that most hunters are actually conservationists that want to see a healthy balance in nature so that they can enjoy it for all that it's there for and be able to go out and enjoy the forest. It's not just about the harvest of the animal. It's really about seeing nature and seeing the beauty that is all around us on both of these forks.
So you hunters think that they're protecting nature? Is that what you're saying?
I think so. I certainly do. I feel that I'm doing my role to help nature kind of stay in balance, for sure.
Yeah?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you also feel you're playing a role in your community where you live?
I do, and it's definitely something I have a passion for. Like I said earlier, there's so many sides to how you manage an overpopulation of deer. And in some ways, holding serve is even a victory. It's going to be very tough to ever really get a true handle on this overpopulation of deer. There are a lot of pieces to that pie, and hunting is one of them, and it's the one that I'm the most passionate about and know the most about, to be honest.
It's also the most effective.
I find it to be the most effective. There are plenty of other stories you've talked about. There are some that I'm not overly versed on, but you have sterilization. You've got it. That doesn't reduce a herd. The cost is off the charts. That doesn't stop a deer from running in front of your car. I mean, no, just because there's a collar on it. I don't know that wildlife was meant to have a collar with a blinking red light in front of its head.
So you think people around here now see hunters differently than they did maybe 10 years ago?
Oh, I do. Number one, there's always been hunting. And I think that a lot of times there have been hunters that people never even knew were even hunting in the woods. They didn't see a lot of it. They just weren't exposed to it. And because of this overpopulation of deer and the really connection between deer, ticks, and Lyme disease, they've kind of all just gotten lumped together. I don't really see that as a problem out here. There's always the town is supportive of it. I think communities are supportive of it, whether they like it or not. Plenty of people that I have access to hunt their property may or may not like hunting. They understand the need for it, and they'll come out and tell you, okay, I'm okay with it, may not want to see it, don't want to be a part of it, but thank you for doing something about it. That's all I can ask for in their mind. At least they're open-minded.
I had a question. If you were king and ruled the land, what would you decree and what regulations and laws would you eliminate? You may not actually be king, but you have recently accepted the position of chairman of the town's deer.
I am the co-chairman of the Southold Deer Management Task Force. I propose an open-minded view. We are a deer task force. Hunting is one of our big topics, but we also look at it from so many different angles and from the aspect of the town. You have a town issue where you have town lands that are owned that the town should be able to protect and not let them get wiped out. Then you also have the role of the town making sure that it's doing what it can for the community, people that own private land. So one of the things that we're looking to do this year is involve homeowners associations just to help them understand the laws, what they can do as a homeowners association to possibly help open their properties up to hunters. And I don't think there's anything wrong with setting expectations and saying, this is what we would like to see achieved. Let's say we'd like you to harvest 5 deer this year as a goal. Put a goal there. And if it can't be accomplished, open your mind to saying, well, then we're going to have to bring another group of people in to hunt, or we're going to ask a different hunter to come in next year, appreciate it, you didn't get here as much as you wanted to. Maybe try to get a representative from the homeowners association to come in, give them information so that they in turn can go back and maybe be able to talk about it. That's one area we're proposing. I'd like to see our donations go up again. As a town, we've had a truck for people to donate deer, a cooler. Mm. That meat is then in turn butchered and given out to various shelters on Long Island. I'd like to see that number go up. Since 2010, we've donated over 30,000 pounds of meat to homeless shelters. And that is a huge number.
How much does a typical deer weigh?
I would say if you get 40 to 60 pounds of venison meat per deer by the time it's butchered, that's a pretty good number. And that's over the course of, say, 5 years. I know last year we had over 200 deer donated again by recreational hunters and also some damage hunters that were doing it in the nuisance season. Nuisance hunters are permit. You actually will be, number one, you need the permission of the landowner to put you on that nuisance hunting permit. Right. There's people that have come from further west up in the island that are participating in it, I'm sure.
It's very complicated, you know, if you haven't sort of grown up with this. So all this meat has been donated. And when it's donated, do people welcome it? Are they really happy to have it?
I've seen great success with that. Not only is some of the meat donated to certain shelters, the town of Southhold itself has set up where they had some meat butchered and people could come and pick it up for themselves. They are also able to pick up an entire deer if they want to. They sign a form, they're able to pick up the deer from the cooler itself and they can take it home and butcher it themselves at no cost.
And they do that?
I'll tell you, it happens all the time. Whatever people do not take that is sent to a butcher that butchers that meat that is paid from the state, butchers the meat, and the meat is then in turn distributed, packaged.
Yeah.
Yes.
So they go straight to the food pantry with it. They don't have like a shop.
Right now, you're not able to sell it. That's a whole new debate. There is talk of trying to legalize the sale of venison. There's a lobby out there. There are a few states. I know Connecticut's been involved. I don't know that one's getting solved anytime soon.
The irony of the whole thing is that it's illegal to sell venison. It's okay to give it away or to eat it yourself.
Correct.
It's illegal to sell it.
Unless it's farm-raised or there is a totally separate U.S. Department of Agriculture, you can obviously purchase venison in various restaurants, but that venison was not harvested in the wild. I've heard from Australia, a lot of different places. So I don't know whether it comes from the U.S. or not.
I'm always shocked to be reminded that selling venison is illegal in this country, but importing it from New Zealand or elsewhere is not.
It's hard to believe that we haven't figured that out.
But there is lobbying going on about
there
that.
There is. I do not have a vast knowledge of how that lobby goes, but it has become a topic that is gaining some steam, for sure.
So if that happened and venison could be sold, you've also, I think, talked to me about paying hunters. In a way, that's the same thing. If you pay hunters for the meat that they shoot, harvest, and you're allowed to sell it, then a whole new economy.
Well, there is an economy with it. I would look at it the same way as, like, for people that go shellfishing, and there are commercial shellfishers that are clammers. For people that go commercial fishing, if you make deer an agricultural crop, which is basically what you would be doing, obviously the state would be involved with it, but it would let them have a very good understanding of areas that might have disease within the herd. And if it's not good enough and tested, then it's not for sale. It would also give them ideas of numbers, give them ideas of health, age structure within the deer herd. So I could see a lot of trickle-down science that could be learned from that, not to mention jobs. So I think it's something that is going to be interesting if it does turn out that that's a way to do it. To my knowledge, we don't have one of the bigger diseases that affect deer is called chronic wasting disease. Mm-hmm. There are maybe parts of New York State that they've had to deal with this, but to date, Long Island does not have that issue. They just are a host for ticks.
How do you feel about deer? You said you used to like to, or even now you like to just look at them when they're around sometimes, but as a hunter, how do you feel about killing an animal? Would you feel differently about shooting a cat or a dog?
There's a part when you do take the animal's life that is very solemn, especially for me personally. I can't speak for everybody. But for me as a person, there is in some sense relief because you've humanely and as quickly as possible harvested the animal. But there you've also realized that this animal is no longer alive. And so it's not exactly a jump for joy moment for me personally. Solemn is the word I would use. And I usually try to take a moment and just reflect on it and reflect on what it's going to help my family with and what it can provide for me. And that's really when the work begins, when you do harvest the animal.
So your kids, do you tell them that, the solemn or the appreciative thing?
I mean, I think you deal with it with your children when their first goldfish dies. I've always sort of had that kind of approach to it and understanding that, yes, it's not a fun thing. It's hamsters die, everything dies. But if you do take a life, obviously, I don't think that it's something that should be just completely cherished. The kill of the hunt is not the thrill of the hunt. It's all that leads up to it. The reflection, the being in nature, seeing the animal, the challenge of it. It's not easy to do. So it is solemn.
Have you shot things that were pests, like a raccoon or something like that?
That's not my favorite part of hunting, but it's part of hunting. And I think it gives you a good perspective to be very good at it when you do.
The efficiency with which you kill the animal is important to you.
Oh, of course. And you wouldn't want to see anything wounded. Unfortunately, it is part of it. It does happen. And when it does happen and you have to get through that process, you make sure you don't let it happen again.
It must be a mixture of things which include, oh good, got rid of one of them now, as well as, oh, here's some tasty venison. I mean, there must be a lot of emotions.
That's the shame of it, that, and that's really what hunting has started to turn into out here, especially on Long Island, is people have really begun to view white-tailed deer, because they are so adaptable, as pests. I can see that side of it. I just hate thinking about it that way. I definitely do my part to try to harvest as many antlerless does as I can have an opportunity to shoot in a season. But I never really look at it like, oh, I've gotten one more out of the herd. I try to just look at it, and I want to see a healthy deer herd. And to get to that point, that's what I have to do it.
Is there anything that you can say about the town deer management committee, about the work that it does? Is it all just about hunting?
The goal of the committee is to try to educate, understand, and deal with the overpopulation of deer that we've got, and to figure out what makes sense to see if we can at least hold serve, get it to wrangle in, just break even. But it still affects other things. It's not just the trees. It affects turtles. It affects salamanders. It affects the regrowth of the forests. So that's all things that the town's aware of, and things that we try to do as a deer committee, figure out how we can make that better.
So has your college training in agricultural economics served you well?
Not really. I think it served me well just as an understanding. I was always interested in the environment, but, you know, I really was not a fantastic college student to begin with.
Is there anything you want to say about living on the North Fork?
I mean, I think the North Fork is beautiful, and as both forks are equally beautiful. I truly love where we live. I love that you can be in 30 seconds by the water and by yourself most of the time, even in the peak of summer. It's still just so beautiful. And to be able to enjoy the outdoors, to fish, to hunt, all within 5 minutes of where I live, makes me feel very lucky. And one of the reasons I love living on the North Fork. I love what the North Fork is. And I mean, yes, to think that it's going to change at some point. It's an agricultural fork. And so if you're going to grow pumpkins, and we're going to save the land to grow the pumpkins and the grapes and the trees, then you want as much traffic as you can get out here on a Saturday or a Sunday to buy it. Yeah. That's what supports our economy. So
I just personally feel one has to be vigilant, that you always have to sort of have this, I want to protect this.
Absolutely. And I think that they've done a pretty good job, actually. Yeah. I think the town takes a lot of note and very receptive to really any sort of thing you bring to them.
Okay, well, it's good to end on a optimistic note. So thank you very much, Dave.
It's been a pleasure, Hazel. Thank you.
You heard Dave Dominey, resident of Cutchogue, talking about his life and work as a carpenter, a recreational hunter, and a member of the Southold Town Deer Management Task Force. North Fork Works comes to you on WPKN on the first Wednesday of every month at 7:30 p.m.